it's going to stay strong until the Fed pivots. Now, I think the Fed's going to pivot by the end of 3Q22. So I think we may be seeing a pivot in the dollar, maybe a topping process in the dollar, because ultimately, when push comes to shove, the Fed's going to have to, in my view, finance the U.S. government effectively. We saw when that happened from April 2020 through whatever, May 2021, that was empirically not good for the dollar.
Welcome to Wealthion. I'm Wealthion founder Adam Taggart. Thanks for joining us for part two of our interview with macro analyst Luke Grohman. If you haven't yet watched part one of this discussion with Luke, in which he explains why he sees the Fed and other world central banks being forced to pivot away from tightening by the end of Q3, if not sooner, head over to our channel at youtube.com/Wealthion and watch it there first. It sets the context for the investment themes we discuss in this video. And we also tell you how to watch bonus footage of Luke explaining the origin story of how he became one of the most respected macro analysts in the business. So be sure to stick around to the end of the video for that. Okay, let's get started watching part two of our interview with Luke Grohman. And, you know, this is coming from the same folks that said, hey, when it gets serious, you have to lie. The fact that they're now all of a sudden waving this red flag on like, hey, you know, might get a lot more painful than it's been already in both the financial markets and in housing. So they're even trying to kind of tell people to assume the crash position here a little bit. So anyways, back to the question, what odds do you think we have of entering recession here and how bad do you think it could get?
I think in Europe, it's 100%. And I think how bad it gets depends on how much they antagonize Putin. I think if he turns off the gas, it's going to be really, really bad, and it's not going to necessarily be deflationary.
I don't know what word comes after depression, but that's where you go when they shut the energy off.
Yeah, and that's, you know, people seem to forget that. Listen, if they shut the energy off, it's not like people show up and go to work and do nothing in those types of situations. They don't. They go and they find food for their families. They, you know,
it's a much broader systemic
breakdown. That's right. Yeah. You start tearing apart the furniture for warmth. Exactly. So there's a non-linearity to it that Europe has that's unique relative to the U.S. in that we're okay on that. Now, certain parts of the U.S. would have to compete with Europe on international gas markets. So that could be really fun for, you know, the east coast of the U.S. in the winter, having to spend, you know, gas is $9 today, is, you know, natural gas $9 today, 30, 40, 50, 100, 200 for gas. Why not? So to answer the question, I think it's 100% Europe. I think they're already in one. I think in the U.S. it's probably 99%, and that's just to give myself a little bit of an out.
A little wiggle room.
And I think it's heavily dependent on, and now again, on a real basis, I think the odds are 100% or 90%, 99%. On a nominal basis, that depends on the policymakers, to your point. You know, if they revert, I think we're going to be in a recession on a real basis, but nominal GDP, I think, will surge. Because I think inflation will resume and set new highs for this cycle. So how bad will it be? Here, too, I think it's what do the policymakers do? If they stand aside nominally, it's going to be really bad because the debt's so high. And I think, as I noted before, the supply, we've never gone into a recession with a starting point of debt to GDP in the US at 122% and deficits, you know, lows for the cycle at 6%. Those have been previous highs, right? At the end of the recession, they're 6, not the beginning of the recession. So the point is that there's gonna be a supply-demand dynamic in treasuries we've never seen before. Which is to say, I think in the U.S. recession, even a modest one, I think you're going to see yields up unless the Fed is much more aggressive with QE. And so that's why I say it depends on how the policymakers react. Because you go into recession and yields start going up in a recession, that just is a debt death spiral vortex until right, rates up, you know, yields, you know, we get rates up, receipts down, dollar up, rates up, yields down or receipts down until either, you know, the system collapses or the Fed steps in and does something like they did in 2020 to 2021. So I think it's likely to be, I think it's high risk of recession. I think it's likely to be modest because I think the authorities are going to be so scared to death of that ladder debt death spiral that they are going to jump in as soon as they can and basically do this cycle's version of whatever it takes in the US, in the EU. So that's how I'd answer it. I think we're going to have one. And I think that the severity of it depends on the policymakers.
Okay, Luke, good answer. I want to just get your reaction to something that Bill Fleckenstein said last time I interviewed him, where he thought that there was a potential that if the Fed does pivot in the way in which you think they will, that may be the moment in which it loses the bond market. Where basically the bond market says, all right, you've just proven that you can't get inflation under control. And therefore, we want to now be compensated more for the risk that you don't know what you're doing and you're powerless to stop this. And that rates may actually go up, even though the Fed is out there, stimulating. And I guess you can maybe have a immovable object versus unstoppable force argument over which is going to be stronger, the Fed's unlimited checkbook or the bond vigilantes. Certainly the past couple of decades have showed maybe the pocketbook actually is more powerful. But I'm just curious, what are your thoughts on that potential thesis?
I think it makes a lot of sense. I think it's right. I think this is the cycle where the Fed, I think I wrote last week, the Fed's only choice left is how they want to lose their credibility. By taking the market into a recession and losing the bond market that way, where I think they're going to see rates rise because there's a balance of payments problem in the United States, which is very problematic, where there's not enough buyers for treasuries because everyone's selling treasuries to get dollars because there's so much offshore dollar debt outstanding. Or they can lose it by printing into an inflation. Elevated inflation and yields rise, but real rates decline. And I think that's really it. I don't think, and that's probably as far as Powell had resigned. I don't think there's a way. There may be a brief period of time where it can look like they reestablish their credibility, but it's going to be brief, right? It's going to be the first part of a recession. Where there's this reflexive institutional move toward, oh, deflation, recession by treasuries. So far, by the way, it hasn't happened.
Right.
For the first time ever. But you may actually get, the 10-year treasury yield down a bit for a month or two, maybe even 3 months. But very quickly, that recession is going to create this supply-demand dynamic that is going to necessitate the Fed coming back in. So there's really, like, to me, when I look at things like instruments like the TLT, long dated treasury ETF, right, where price goes up when yields go down and vice versa, the investment case for it is increasingly becoming like a 2 to 3 month window where deflation picks up, the start of a recession, and before the Fed has come in with QE. That's really it, because other than that, they need significantly negative real rates because the debt levels are so high, the deficit levels are so high, and they're so structural. So I think the Fed's really in a situation where it's how do you want to lose your credibility, not do you want to keep your credibility or not lose your credibility, or do you want to keep the bond market or not lose, not keep your lose the bond market or keep the bond market. They're going to lose the bond market. How do you want to lose the bond market? Now, they can make a decision where they're going to say, okay, we're going to let the economy crash and you're going to have all the equities plow into bonds. And yeah, you'll get yields down for like a month or two. And then everyone's going to go, oh God, Luke was right. Equities were a key marginal driver to consumption. And consumption is 2/3 of GDP, which means tax receipts are down 40%. And tax receipts down 40% with consumption going to, down a bunch is, oh God, maybe it's not 40, 30%, right? There's $1.2 trillion, $1.5 trillion, boom. Who's gonna, there's, it, you can't cover the you can't cover the interest like obligations, not even close. So do they default on those treasuries? Do they stand aside while that happens? Because if they do, rates are going to have to rise to
Right.
spur that demand. So it literally is like there's this 1 to 2 month window where they think they can still scare equities and foreigners into treasuries, despite the fact that the evidence is showing otherwise. I mean, again, the TIC report the other day, Chinese and the Japanese, two biggest creditors, are selling because they have to. The dollar's too strong.
Yeah.
So,
Can I use that as a pivot here?
yeah.
So I've really enjoyed the back and forth on Twitter between you and Brent Johnson of San Diego Capital, who's got the dollar milkshake theory. What I enjoy about your back and forths is I think there are points upon which you guys have differences of opinion. But I like the fact that you guys can kind of empirically debate those points back and forth, without too much color. I think you do it in a respectful manner, and it's fun to just see two brains, kick ideas back around here. But it's clear that you guys don't see eye to eye on everything. So I guess big question is what do you predict as the outlook for the U.S. dollar, and let's say over the next year or so? And then also too, once we get in this inflationary, nonlinear future you see, does the dollar still maintain its role as the reserve currency? Is it as bad as it is? Is it still better than everybody else? Or do we actually have a regime change with the leader?
Yeah, so I wrote something last week where I think the way to think about the dollar relative to other currencies is I think oil and gold and gas are going to be better than the ruble, which is going to be better than the dollar, which is going to be better than the euro and the yen and probably the yuan and probably everything else. Maybe the Swiss franc sneaks up above the dollar. Maybe at times the Brazilian real, like it has done this year, these other commodity currencies sneak above the dollar. But from a broad perspective, that's to me the order of operations, right? So it's, oil, gas, gold above ruble, above dollar, above euro, above yen, above yuan, euro above a dollar, above euro, yen, yuan, all sort of in a basket, sterling. And so the point is what's that? So, well, that means that DXY is going to go up because the DXY is all euro and yen. And there have been a couple people, I think, that have pointed it out. Lynn Alden might have pointed it out. I can't remember who it was. Maybe it was Doomberg. But the point is that the dollar is rising against two critically energy short
Currencies.
currencies, and it's falling against the currency that is actually effectively explicitly backing itself with gas. And it's been falling against gold. I saw somebody else point out today, 2017 dollar was at 103, gold was at 1100, 2013 gold dollar at 103, the gold's at 1100, 2017 gold's at 10 or dollars at 103, the Dixie gold's at 1500, 2022 Dixie's at 105, gold's at 1850, right? So it's continuing to lose against gold over time, even as it sort of cycles back and forth, up and down again. But I think so. To answer your question, I think the dollar is going to stay strong for probably it's going to stay strong until the Fed pivots. Now, I think the Fed's going to pivot by the end of 3Q22. So I think we may be seeing a pivot in the dollar, maybe a topping process in the dollar, because ultimately, when push comes to shove, the Fed's going to have to, in my view, finance the US government effectively. We saw when that happened from April 2020 through whatever, May 2021, that was empirically not good for the dollar, and good for other currencies. So I think I still think in the short run, dollar goes up for as long as the Fed is
Talk's tough.
talks tough. The second they fold, I think the dollar is going much lower, and I don't think we're too far from that.
Okay, so let's get down to now to the brass tack. So viewers watch this channel because they are trying to get macro insights from folks like you and trying to see where the puck is headed so that they can make informed decisions on how to place their capital right now. Now you have clients that are trying to make those decisions every day with lots of capital. How do you see the major assets performing from here? Or maybe said slightly differently, for that type of, relatively short-term future, let's say the next 12 months, where dollar's strong for the next quarter or two, but then starts to weaken. Which assets do you think will perform well, and which do you think won't?
Yeah, in that world, I think the things that do well right off the bat, when the Fed pivots, are energy and commodities more broadly, and then Bitcoin probably does well, gold does well. I think stocks broadly do well. You'd be talking about a resumption, I think, of negative real interest rates. So I think equities do really well in that world, broadly speaking. So it basically is a return to sort of the April 20 through 4Q 21 or 2Q 21 liquidity regime with a bit of a twist from the geopolitical side, I think, and what we've seen in terms of commodities. So those are the sectors I think will do best if slash when the Fed pivots.
Okay, and you just said that the dollar's been losing purchasing power against those hard assets. You just walked through gold as a good example of that, but it sounds like that's going to get really turbocharged once this Fed pivot happens, correct?
I think it will. Yeah, I think it will.
Okay, sorry. So I got to ask you Bitcoin since you mentioned it. I know that you have been a pretty good component over the past. Since I've known you, of saying, "Hey, hold gold and hold some Bitcoin." It's been a rough start to the year for Bitcoin, and certainly a rough start to the year for any other coins or tokens in the crypto space. Anything changed in your thesis, understanding, liking of this space, or are you chalking this up to sort of the like, "Hey, the space goes through big corrections from time to time. This is just another one of them."
Yeah, I focus strictly on Bitcoin, and in hindsight, hindsight's always 2020. I wrote to my subscribers last June. I said I've sold most of my Bitcoin to be fully dis, you know, this full disclosure or fully transparent. I used it to pay off my house because I said, you know what, I don't, it seems a little frothy. I love it, but I'm gonna just take some off the table. And if I'd have just stopped there, it'd have been great. I started buying it back throughout the fall and earlier this year. So I'm still not back to where I was in June of last year, June of 21. But I've been buying it too early, and it's been painful. In terms of what my thesis on it hasn't changed at all. Here too, I shared a chart showing the earlier this year showing the price of gold in Weimar Germany. Again, I don't think we're going to hyperinflate, but I think there's some directional, I think extremes inform the means. My point was that I think gold would or Bitcoin would trade a lot like gold in Weimar Germany, which was to say, yeah, it went from zero to a trillion in the local currency, but the you needed to be unlevered and careful because every there were these you lost all of your money four or five different times. In these sort of counter-cyclical moves, the pivots, the tightenings, the austerity, whatever happened. And so I remember saying earlier this year, like, here, we're right here, it seems like for Bitcoin, right before one of these month-over-month changes in the price of gold in Weimar Germany. And again, in hindsight, I should have just sold everything there and bought it all back cheaper, but I didn't. So I still think Bitcoin is effectively a neutral reserve asset tied to energy for the people, a sort of a digital gold. If the Fed pivots and gold and Bitcoin does not participate, I'll need to revisit my view of that and change that. I think it will if when the Fed pivots. But that's what I'm watching for to say, okay, something's changed. I'm wrong. Yeah, owning it has felt terrible, but it's not unexpected. I've been thinking it's going to trade like gold in Weimar Germany as we go through this hyper political process of what we're going through, which is a sovereign debt crisis in the US, around the world, but it's centered in these developing markets. So it's not surprising, but it is painful. But if it doesn't participate in a Fed pivot, then to me, that's going to force a rethink. In terms of how I'm thinking about Bitcoin.
All right. Well, look, there's a lot of questions I'd love to dig into more just about that, but I've got several other ones too I would have loved to dive into, but I've had you on for too long. And for time reasons, we'll have to end it here, Luke, but bring you back on again some point soon to dig into those other elements, especially as things continue to unfold. Definitely want to have you back on here in Q3 to give us an audible, depending upon whatever the Fed has done by that point in time. Real quickly, I want to thank you too for being willing to share your origin story with us, which folks, he's done. If you go to wealtheon.com/LukeOrigin, you can hear how Luke ended up becoming the big macro influencer that he is today. But Luke, real quickly, for folks that want to have enjoyed hearing your answers here, maybe didn't know you so much before this interview, I would like to follow you and your work. Where should they go?
Absolutely. So they can check out our website, fftt-llc.com, or find us on Twitter at Luke Groman, LukeGromen.
All right, great. And Luke, when we edit this, we'll put up the URLs to both of those on the screen here. And I highly recommend folks go check them out. I am a regular reader of both. All right, Luke, well, real pleasure here. Hope to have you back on again soon.
Absolutely. Thanks for having me on. It was great talking to you, Adam.
All right, well, now's the time of the program where we bring in the lead partners from New Harbor Financial, one of the financial advisory firms endorsed by Wealthion. I'm joined today by Mike Preston. His cohort, John Loder, is away for the week. Mike, great to have you on here. Let's jump right in. So Luke was basically setting the stage for us, saying that the big story that's playing out here is the final ending throes of the global sovereign debt crisis, centered here in the U.S., in which he thinks that it is going to end in some sort of default, whether it's a deflationary one or an inflationary one. And he believes that when push comes to shove, it is going to be a path of inflation to the end here. So what did you have to think? What do you think about everything that Luke had to say there in this interview?
Yeah, hi Adam. Thanks for having me back. Get to talk to you a couple times this week. It's excellent.
Yeah, it's fun.
Yeah, he talks about, this debt bubble, which is massive. And he's right. It's $200 trillion of debt worldwide. And that's not even counting all the derivatives that are attached to that. And there's only a few ways out of that. You can default on the debt, you can inflate away the debt. His conclusion is that we probably will try to inflate away the debt. That's almost certainly correct, although we can't guarantee that. That's likely the path that things are going to take. And yeah, this talk was fascinating. I learned some new things. I learned some new things every day. And it certainly reminded me of a number of different data points that are pretty extreme. I think that we've been living in an extreme time from in an economic point of view for, certainly since 2008. And it becomes normal because it's so constantly extreme. But we have to remind ourselves it's not normal. And the risks that we're running here on a constant basis are extremely high. And in a system that's this stretched and this extreme in terms of intervention, a lot of things can happen. And most of them are not good. Just picking out a couple different data points here. Luke said that 70% of tax receipts are paid out in entitlements. I have to admit, I didn't know that. I mean, that basically says almost all the taxes that come in are paid out in terms of entitlements, economic support, et cetera. And as we enter a recession, which we're probably almost certainly entering now, tax receipts will drop sharply, and we're going to have to issue more treasuries. And so it's kind of a vicious cycle. Tax receipts drop suddenly, the government can't pay its obligations. We have to issue more treasuries. Issuing more treasuries pushes the price of treasuries down, which drives interest rates up, all at a time when inflation is also likely not only raging, but what is necessary to handle the debt bubble. So, he mentioned Paul Volcker, certainly a hero of mine who broke the back of inflation in the 1980s. Luke points out that the debt to GDP, that is the total debt divided by the gross domestic product of the US, total production was about 25%. So Volcker had the ability to break the back of inflation because our debt was so low. Now we're at 120% of GDP. And to break the back of inflation, you have to raise interest rates sharply, substantially. You really can't do that with a debt to GDP ratio of 120% because the government can't afford to pay for it. So, yeah, the Fed is trapped. We're now facing tightening or increasing interest rates into a recession. We talked, I think, this week also about margins going down at the corporate level. Certainly margins are going to go down, you know, which is going to cause earnings to go down, which is going to cause the PE ratio or the measure of valuation to go much higher, which means valuations are going to look bad even if the market goes lower. So really, we should remind ourselves why we're in this problem in the first place. It's because we've kicked the can 100 times, 1,000 times in the last 10 or even 20 years. So I think that, you know, our message is remaining the same. You know, be careful. It's not going to be easy. This bear market is almost certainly not going to stop at almost exactly 20% and go up from here. I know that there's still a lot of optimism out there, and the financial media says, you know, what's the next play? How can you make money off the bounce? We think the narrative is different going forward, and the thing to do is to be tactical and cautious.
Tactical and cautious. I think it's very wise. Yeah, so great summary, Mike. You know, I think Luke has been really right over the time I've known him to really sort of laser focus in on what the true big issue here, which is the global sovereign debt crisis, right? This is, at the end of the day, it's a problem of too much debt. And as we've let our debts grow, and we've largely done that to pull tomorrow's prosperity into today, that's what politicians and, you know, folks in general have wanted to do. They've basically sacrificed tomorrow for an immediate benefit today. And at some point, the piper has to be paid, and you nailed it, Mike. You know, they've just been kicking the can and kicking the can and kicking the can for as long as they can. But at some point, you do run out of road to be able to do that, right? And increasingly, the authorities are finding themselves caught between a rock and a hard place. And the rock is this massive mountain of debt that's built up over time, which increasingly limits our opportunities. And the hard place is now, you know, the repercussions of kicking that can all the way down the road is, you know, you have things like we're seeing now with inflation, right, where it's almost sort of no matter which path you pick, you're going to end up losing. And so sort of like Luke was saying, you know, he said, hey, look, the Fed's going to lose the bond market here no matter what they choose. The question isn't how do they avoid losing the bond market? The question is how do you want to lose the bond market? Right. So anyways, that all gets down to, okay, in this crazy world where we may be kind of at the end of this decades long process where the road has run out and the chickens come home to roost. I'll mash as many analogies together here as I can. But how do we as regular people allocate our own personal capital here to make sure that we're not going to get destroyed, you know, whichever happens here? And obviously some diversification is really important because nobody knows for certain which of those two paths we're going to go down, even though I think you and I and Luke are a little more confident on the inflation side. But Luke, as you said, you know, he said in the short term, he doesn't think that the Fed can act as tough as it's talking. And as he said, he thinks it's going to pivot, and he thinks it's going to pivot by the end of Q3 or sooner, which really is not all that far away at this point in time here in late June. So, you know, we if he's right, we're going to get that pivot. And Luke says when that happens, he expects commodities to do well, particularly gold and energy stocks, also lumped Bitcoin in there. He also think the broad equity market will do well, just like it did well when the Fed, you know, and Congress dumped trillions of stimulus into the markets. He said it's kind of going to be like April 2020 to Q4 2021 redo, where kind of just all boats rise to a certain extent. But I think it's also going to be a totally new world, right? Where if the Fed pivots by then, inflation is by no means going to be brought under control. So we will be doing all of that in the face of still hot and persisting inflation. Of course, all that's just going to make the inflation even worse, right? And as we talked about, the Fed may lose the bond market at that point in time. And so rates may not go lower. A lot of people betting on the pivot think, okay, pivot means lower bond rates. Not necessarily this time around. So it's going to be really, really interesting. You know, I think given your guys' allocation, you should in general be okay there, but don't let me put words in your mouth. You know, what are you guys thinking right now from a capital allocation standpoint?
Well, yeah, let me just make a couple comments about what we're doing in our model, in our portfolio right now. And we, you know, we're roughly flat year to date. You know, don't hold me to an exact number, but we're roughly flat.
Sorry, let me just interject to reinforce that. You're flat year to date. The S&P, I think, while it bounced a little bit, is still down around 20% for the year. NASDAQ a lot more than that. And the average stock is down a lot worse than the general indices. So flat is pretty darn good given most other alternatives, right?
Yeah, approximately flat. Depending upon the day, we might be down 1%, up a fraction of a percent, but, you know, roughly flat. And the S&P is down around 21%. We have a plan. We have a process, you know, for no matter what happens. And we are focused heavily on capital preservation right now. Just last week, we made a couple trades. We did stop out of a position, our basic materials position. We took a loss on it. We had a certain stop. We hit the stop, we took it, and we're out. So we took a small loss on that.
But another position. Sorry to interrupt again, but can you just quickly define what a stop is for the people who don't know? Because I talk a lot about how you guys are very skilled employers of hedging techniques, and that is a common hedging technique that pretty much everybody can use, correct?
Yes, absolutely. There's a lot of different ways to hedge. One of them is to basically set a level at which you say, this asset or this security has now breached a level that I didn't think it would have, but it did. And therefore my thesis was wrong. So you sell. You know, this particular asset was trading up around in the 80s, and we had hedged it with options. And so we defrayed some of the downside, but we said, if it closes below 79 in this particular instance, we're going to sell it. It closed below 79. We sold it. And it was trading around 74 or 75 right now. Sometimes after you take a stop, that asset will bounce right back. It doesn't matter. What really matters is that you have a plan and that you stick to it. Because if you don't have a plan, you're going to find out that you become frozen. So, you know, we did take a stop and we sold that position for a loss. A second position, the energy position we have, we sold on Friday for a gain. We had a short call written or sold against that position. The option expired. It was in the money and it was sold. And it's not that we don't like energy, oil service and energy. We do, but we felt like it was a good time to sell it, step to the sideline, and then look to re-enter. We probably will re-enter that sector at some time soon. But because of those two sales, we have virtually zero net stock market exposure at the moment. We've got a good amount of cash, and we're actually looking to deploy tactically a position on a further drop in the market. We're targeting around 3,600, maybe 3,550 in the S&P, which is in around 3,800 right now. And we'll do so by buying a piece, maybe 10 or 15% of an account in one of the major indexes. And then we'll sell an option against it, a call option, to bring in premium. All we're really trying to do is to collect that premium. It's equivalent to a short put strategy to those that understand options, but never are we using leverage. It's a very, very modest exposure, and we have a lot of opportunity to adjust that and to sell or buy different layers as the market falls further. So my best guess is that the S&P might go between 32 and 3600. On what I think is the first kind of acceleration down, we haven't even really seen that yet. And that would probably be a place that we might bounce for a while from. But ultimately, we think we're in a longer bear market here. You know, we'll see. I mean, Luke was saying that he thinks that stocks will do well if we get the Fed pivot in Q3. He might be right. I'm looking at the calendar. Q3 is only about 10 days away. You know, not even, just a little over a week away, Q3 starts. So we might get a bounce, but from what level is the real question? Maybe we go to 3,200 on the S&P. And then we bounce straight up to where we are now. Who knows? But that's how we're looking at it right now, with very little to no stock market exposure, looking to layer in on a further drop below, you know, maybe 3,600.
Okay. And you guys have been very consistent about saying that any type of bounce or rally right now, you guys are using as an opportunity to lighten up, to sell, et cetera. And you just gave a couple examples of that. So it sounds like you're sticking to that. You and I talked earlier this week about the potential next shoe to drop in the financial markets, which is going to be margin compression. We talked about that in the interview with Peter Buchvar. Folks, if you haven't watched that interview yet, it's a really good one. I'll put up a link to it here. But basically, forward earning estimates for next year have really not come down much at all yet, despite all of the carnage going on in the underlying fundamentals. And I think they're still, on average, projecting 10% earnings growth right now for the S&P, which honestly is pretty much kind of boggles the mind when you see all the data that shows that, both the organic demand destruction from high prices right now, but all the demand destruction the Fed is trying to engineer right now. The big concern from my perspective, at least, is that we're going into recession, and we should be arguing how big of one, where Wall Street analysts just haven't taken that into consideration yet. And what Peter is saying is that because we're about to go into Q3, as Mike was saying, the Q2 earnings calls are going to start in about 2+ weeks or so. And that's when we're really going to start hearing, in a way that the Wall Street analyst can't ignore, the profit hits that corporate America is taking right now from the reduction in demand. And then the companies themselves will be walking down their forward guidance, which is going to force the analysts to have to do that. Mike, you said that you think that we could get down to 3,600 or maybe even less on the S&P. This could actually be the event that gets us there. All right. Well, Mike, well, a few more things to dial through here, Mike, but real quick, let me get your response to that one on margin compression.
Yeah, absolutely. Like you said the other day and said today, margin compression is already happening. It likely will continue to happen. I don't know if it's going to wait for the next round of earnings reports. I think that the market's already figuring that out. The market does tend to to look forward. And again, I think that the broad range that this market could get to, will probably get to, though nobody can guarantee the future, is 3,200 to 3,600 on the S&P, and the charts support that. So yeah, no matter what the catalyst is, that's where I think the range is, and we certainly will be looking to take action there. And I should also say, anecdotally, we talk to a lot of people. I've talked to a handful of people this week. I had a call today with somebody that had a lot of gains in the stock market, and yet they feel like they've lost. I really want people to understand the psychology, because I've been in this business since the 90s, and I've seen people's psychology, and I've seen what happens in deep bear markets. At first you tend to, you wait for a bounce back up, or you're bargaining about the money that was lost, and then you're waiting for some level to get back to even. I see that in full force right now, more than I've seen before, to be honest. More than I've seen in March of 2020. Back then, it was so fast and recovered so fast that very few people had time to react. Now we're 6 months into a bear market.
Yeah, and sorry to interrupt here, but I think a big difference there was, as everything was unfolding back during the pandemic, you had the government out every day saying it was going to do whatever it takes. Now you've got the Fed on the other side of the script.
It's true. And we're 6 months into this market, which has been really kind of slow. This bear market has been slow and methodical, at least so far. It's the point where we see the first waterfall that we want to buy our first piece. Now, it's dangerous because we could easily just crash from there. But the point is, you have to have a plan. And you want to be going contrary to the crowd. What I'm seeing right now is people that feel like they've lost money. Most of the 2021's gains have been wiped out. But still, there's massive gains for anyone that's been in this market, that's ridden this parabola up. This 2021 was a blow-off top, in my opinion, in almost everything. Houses, Bitcoin, meme stocks, SPACs, stock market, all of it. I mean, in Bitcoin, of course, everyone can see what's happening there. It's one of the many things that should be really worrying people, but the kind of the real awareness moment hasn't happened yet. And almost every conversation I'm having now with people that are not yet clients is, they're like, should I sell here? Should I wait for a bigger bounce? And I understand the psychology. If we roll over now and take out those lows, that's what causes the waterfall moment when people say, forget it, I'm out. So I'd urge anyone to really evaluate what type of investor you are here. If you're a buy and holder, that's totally fine. As long as you hold it for maybe the rest of your life, you'll be fine. The market will always come back eventually. It might take 10 plus years, who knows? But if you're ever, doubting what type of investor you are, now's a really good time to think about that and maybe reallocate and it become a little more tactical. Raise some cash, drop your equity exposure down, maybe to 30%. And it will give you some flexibility to act in the years ahead, if I'm right. I mean, there's no guarantee I'm right, but this is what history says and the data says, is that we're at the early phases of a bear market that's going to get a little bit, maybe a lot more uncomfortable.
All right. Great, great point. You nailed a number of things here I would quickly comment on. You know, Wealthion, from its mission, is all about helping people develop financial resilience, right? And resilience takes on a heightened premium in uncertain times, right? Because the definition of resilience is sort of no matter what happens, you're going to be okay, right? And I think this really underscores your note here about having a plan, Mike, because when things get uncertain, emotions get high, and emotions are like our absolute worst enemy when it comes to investing, because they generally pressure us to make the exact wrong decision at the exact wrong time. You sort of alluded to the five stages of grief, and we've talked in past videos about how that's kind of the process that investors go through as losses start to mount, right? First, it's denial. Then you're bargaining with yourself. Okay, if it just gets back to where it was, then I'll sell it, right? And so the antidote to being doomed to going through that, those cycles of grief, is to have a plan, right? And to take the emotion out of it, kind of like your stops. It's more like a computer algorithm. If this happens, then I'll do this, right? And you just trust the plan that hopefully you put together under the tutelage of a professional financial advisor who understands all these macro risks. And having that plan is going to, you know, be for a lot of people kind of like a lifeline through all the emotional chaos and uncertainty that we're going to go through. And it's funny, you were just talking about how, you know, people are really beginning to emotionally grieve the losses they're taking, even if they're still sitting on a lot of long-term gains. And again, that all goes back to our human emotional wiring, right? We always top tick our expectations. We anchor on what the maximum was. So whether it was justified or not, all we know is, hey, 12 months ago, this thing was worth X, now it's worth less than that. And oh my gosh, I'm so much worse off now, even if you're still up, you know, 300% from your initial buy-in price. And we're going to see this happen, folks, I have a high degree of confidence, in the housing market. The housing gains, the 20% that the housing market added on over the past year, I think is highly likely to go relatively quickly here as housing, you know, begins to correct. And we've discussed on this program recently with a number of different experts how quickly it's cooling here. And you can make a really easy argument that those were phantom gains. There really was no justification for them. It was just sort of a mania in a lot of these housing markets. But that doesn't matter. The human mind is anchored on, well, my property was worth this crazy amount, and now it's worth 20% less, 30% less. And not only does that make us feel bad, but it actually makes us feel poor. We change our spending behavior based on that. It's a negative wealth effect that then, you know, in this current slowing economy, you know, is going to influence, it's going to be a depressive effect on consumer spending, and that is going to potentially accelerate this recession that we're likely headed into here. So, you know, it's not immaterial. So anyways, and one other thing emotionally I want to underscore here, I think I mentioned it on a relatively recent video here, but is prospect theory, which is psychological research that shows that people emotionally feel the pain of a loss roughly about 2 times more intensely than they feel the joy of a gain. So most investors have kind of almost known nothing but the joy of the gain for the past decade. We may now be entering into a period where a lot of them are going to be feeling that pain of the loss. And it's just a reminder, get to gird yourself emotionally. You're going to be feeling that about 2 times more than you felt the good on the way up here. I see you smiling as I'm saying all this, Mike.
Yeah, I think so. I mean, I know that some people think that there's too much pessimism in the market, but I can tell you that there's still a lot of optimism. You know, we're very, very early in the stages again, because, you know, even if they're overexposed, a lot of people are waiting for that bounce to sell into. Just a couple of data points. If you look at the AAII numbers, the American Association of Individual Investors, in May, they're showing an allocation of 67% stocks. You know, that's still a relatively high allocation. And maybe this is data mining, but this is a real piece of data. In March of 2009, that number was 40.8, the AAII number. So, you know, still 67% allocation. That'll change over time. If you look at the VIX futures curve, we haven't seen an inversion of the curve where the front month VIX, you know, is a lot higher than the than the FAR month. And there's something called the 1-3 month, you know, kind of VIX curve. If you see front month VIX or volatility futures go a lot higher than far out months, you know, that signals usually, nothing's foolproof, a bottom. My point is we've seen very little fear or panic, at least insofar as those data points suggest. And just, you know, from my own talking to people, I seems like there's a little bit of fear out there now, but it's certainly not pervasive. And it's very unlikely that this bear market hits exactly whatever it was, 22% on the S&P and then bottoms from there. It could happen, but it's not likely. Valuations are still extreme, even here. So there's still time. There's still time to reallocate and to get more conservative.
Great. I think that's a key point that folks should take away from this discussion, which is if you are not feeling comfortable about how you're currently positioned, there's still time, right? You haven't missed the boat. It's not too late to take the right steps to do whatever's going to be the right thing to do with your portfolio. Two quick data points to what you mentioned there, Mike. So the VIX right now is at about 28. And for folks that don't know what the VIX is, it's a volatility measurement. 28 is slightly elevated from where we've been over the past, you know, bunch of years, but it is not in crisis territory at all. You know, if we're in like a real kind of stock market panic where folks are really freaking out, I mean, the VIX could be closer to 100. And so that's one sign there. Also, if you look at the put call ratio, which is sort of another metric of how bearish people are, it's kind of back to sort of its normal average at this point in time. So just underscoring, Mike, that, you know, whether we're looking at the numbers or whether we're talking to people like you do on an everyday basis, you know, we're not seeing that kind of capitulative fear and panic that generally signal the end of a bear market here, right? Could things bounce from here? Could we have some big face ripper bounces like most bear markets in history are full of? Absolutely. But for those that are basically, looking for the all clear that, all the bad is over and it's going to be sunny days ahead, I don't think we've got a lot of data to suggest that we can make that call here. All right, well, look, in wrapping up real quickly, I just want to note, we talked last time you were on, Mike, about the, right before we had come on to record, the White House had done a press conference where the press secretary, Karine Jean-Pierre, came out and said, hey, folks, we don't see any recession. In fact, we think we're transitioning into a period of stable and increasing growth from here. And you and I kind of guffawed at that a little bit just because we just don't know what hallucinogenic lens they were looking through to make that prediction. But what's interesting now is we're seeing what I would call almost sort of signs of desperation here, as President Biden has really been turning the screws on the oil and gas industry right now to bring gasoline prices down. And there's been a very public back and forth with the CEOs of the major oil companies. But just today, President Biden asked Congress to act and pause the federal gas tax, which actually I'm all for. I love reducing taxes on people, but it's kind of a too little too late type of maneuver here. It's not going to be a huge game changer for folks. I'm just curious, Mike, we've got a November election coming up. Obviously, the Democrats are very nervous about it because they stand to lose the most here. But you and I have talked an awful lot about how we're bumping up against limits that the authorities really don't have a lot of control over, right? So like Federal Reserve can print trillions of dollars of thin air tomorrow if it wants to, but it can't create any more oil. It can't get a single additional barrel of oil or gallon of gasoline into a gas tank any faster, than physics, the laws of physics are going to allow here. So, do you sort of see this increasing desperation by the folks running the system here that they are beginning to really slam into like hard real world limits that we've been able to kind of ignore for the past couple of decades as we just swung the proceeds of the magic checkbook around everywhere?
I think so. I think we're approaching the proverbial end of the road. You know, it's only common sense that you can't do extreme things in terms of over intervention forever, you know, without consequence. You know, I mean, even the Roman Empire ultimately had problems when they were reducing the precious metal content in their coins over the years. And, you know, eventually that came back to bite them. They couldn't print their way into conquering the entire world. And that's just only one example. I mean, we have had a lot of hubris thinking that we could prevent any and all discomfort, any and all decline, or even recession we could avert, because this is the new world. We figured out quantitative easing, and you know, it's gone so far as to have negative interest rates around the world. And at the peak, we had something like $19 trillion in negative yielding sovereign debt. It was ridiculous. And, you know, and then there's all this talk about modern monetary theory, almost like an illusion. This whole thing's an illusion. Nothing matters because we can fix it all. And, you know, that's not really, I don't think, what's going to happen. And how we gave a small group of people such immense power, I have no idea. And their predictions are very contradictory. You know, it's very political. For years, we heard, well, you know, we don't have enough inflation. We want more inflation. We're targeting 2% inflation. Well, all of a sudden, we've got 8 or 9% inflation. And it's a political hot button. And now I'm pretty sure the president is pretty keen on doing something about it, and almost certainly probably leaning on Jerome Powell and the rest of the Federal Reserve to do something about it. And now the Federal Reserve says they're dedicated to bringing inflation under control. But, you know, that's all within the space of a few years. It's pretty crazy.
Yeah. And sorry to interrupt here, but not only is the administration leaning on the Federal Reserve to get prices under control. So what's the Fed doing? It is trying to kill demand, right? But just yesterday, today, the administration also has been floating the idea of issuing every U.S. household gas cards that basically have, you know, like gas card gift certificates where you can go and use this to buy gas, right? So it's basically another form of stimulus, right? So it's so contradictory, right? It's saying, pal, prices have gotten too high because we pushed too much stimulus out there. Get demand down. At the same time, maybe we should just send people a bunch of, you know, free vouchers for gasoline, which is basically exactly more of the same issue that created the problem in the first place. This is kind of what I was talking about, that sort of like desperate thinking that's going on right now.
It is. And you can control prices of commodities in the short term. Like, for instance, the president could release the Strategic Petroleum Reserve. That would cause prices to dive short term. You can eliminate the gas tax for 3 months. You know, that will...
You can enforce price controls. I mean, it's happened at many times throughout history. It works for a couple of weeks, but then you create...
You will lose control over the long term, because oil and commodities in general, it's a global market, and equilibrium will reassert itself. And all the intervention comes at the cost of something else, right? So everything's got a cost. And I think we are reaching the end of the road where... I think it will become clear that all of this intervention actually made us worse off, not better off. And it shifted the wealth balance in this country pretty extremely. I mean, you really can't, you can't create prosperity. I think that you've said this before, you can't print prosperity. You can transfer wealth, you know, and that's all that's happened. And I, for one, wish for a moment of justice or equilibrium in these markets so we can have some of the freedom back again, you know, but hopefully it doesn't come at too much of a cost in terms of pain for certain folks.
Right, because to get there, likely much lower prices would be required in a lot of areas. And we're not rooting for the pain that people would feel, but we probably, I think, are rooting for, you know, a return to a more sane and sustainable and fairer system. And, you know, because we have distorted for so long, the painful medicine we're going to have to take to get there is... just it's going to be what it's going to be. All right. Well, anyways, look, I wanted to underscore that because I wanted to just provide a coda to your great recommendation there to folks, Mike, of just get your plan in place and be ready, right? And most folks watching this video have probably been watching a lot of our videos in the past, so I'm going to trust you guys have already taken the actions that you need to take. But if you're a newer viewer, Definitely sit down with your professional financial advisor, maybe send them this video and say, hey, how am I currently positioned for the type of future that these guys talked about here? If you don't have a good advisor, or if you'd like a second opinion from one that does understand all this stuff well, perhaps Mike and the team at his firm there at New Harbor, just schedule a free, no strings attached consultation with the advisors endorsed by Wealthion. It's super easy. It doesn't cost you anything. If you're interested in that, stick around to the end of the video. It's coming up in just a couple seconds. We tell you how to do that. Otherwise, folks, if you enjoyed having Luke Roman on this program, would like to see us get him on again, as well as other great minds like him, do me a favor, support this channel by hitting the like button and then clicking on the red subscribe button below, as well as that little bell icon right next to it. And Mike, you know, we're certainly getting into interesting territory here. We're going to probably see it get a lot more interesting as the Q2 earnings calls start coming out. So whatever the future holds in store, we will be tracking it here together. Look forward to seeing you on this program next week. Everybody else, thanks so much for watching.
Thanks so much, Adam. I really enjoyed this conversation. See you soon.
If you'd like to schedule a consultation with one of the financial advisors at New Harbor Financial, simply go to Wealthion.com. These consultations are completely free, and there are no strings attached. The good folks at New Harbor will simply answer any questions you have about your investment goals or your portfolio and give you their best advice given their latest market outlook. They're willing to do this because they care about protecting people's wealth, and because Wealthion has connected them with so many thoughtful investors just like you over the past decade. We started doing this because so many people have approached us in frustration, looking for a solution because they're feeling out of alignment or downright ridiculed by the standard financial advisors who have been managing their money. You know the type. The kind that just pushes all of your money into the market, scoffs at the idea of owning gold, and when you bring up concerns about the market's sky-high valuations, they say, "Don't worry. The market will always take care of you." For many of the reasons discussed in today's video, we think this is one of the most challenging and treacherous times in history for investing. We strongly believe that today's investors are best served working in partnership with a conscientious professional financial advisor who understands the risks in play. Now, we're agnostic which professional advisor you work with, as long as they're good. If you're already working with one, that's fantastic. Stick with them. But if you don't, or are having trouble finding one you respect or trust, then consider talking to John and Mike and the team at New Harbor. Now, for those about to ask, yes, there's a business relationship between Wealthion and New Harbor, which we've put in place to make sure everything is handled according to SEC regulations. All the details on this are clearly provided on the Wealthion.com website. Also, it's important to note that New Harbor is able to work with U.S. citizens, green card holders, and those with existing assets in the USA. But for regulatory reasons, they aren't able to take on non-US clients. All right, with all that said, if you'd like some insight and guidance on how to protect your wealth during this unprecedented time in the markets, go to Wealthion.com to schedule your free consultation with the good folks at New Harbor. Thanks for watching.